morning and welcome to Central Standard Friday. I'm Monroe Dodd. Around the time that the 19th century turned into the 20th century, a most extraordinary man grew up roaming the woods of western Missouri, learning to track and shoot with consummate skill. When the United States went to war in 1917, he went to war, used those skills, and came home with the highest decoration his country could bestow. He was an independent guy who loved nothing more than to do combat his own way. And when peace came, he handled it his way too. This man's name was John Lewis Barclay, born 1895, died 1966, winner of the Congressional Medal of Honor. With us to talk about this fascinating man is Stephen Trout, who wrote the introduction to a new edition of John Lewis Barclay's World War I memoir. Stephen, welcome to Central Standard Friday.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Stephen is a former Kansas Cityan and a World War I scholar, and he teaches at the University of South Alabama. He joins us today by phone from Mobile, Alabama. His most recent book is On the Battlefield of Memory, The First World War and American Remembrance, 1919-1941. Now, John Lewis Barclay's war account, originally published in 1930, has been reissued by the University Press of Kansas with the title Scarlet Fields. Stephen, who was John Lewis Barclay?
Well, John Lewis Barclay was quite a character. He was a, as you mentioned in your opening, he was a rugged outdoorsman. He grew up fishing, hunting, tracking. He knew how to read a landscape, how to camouflage himself, how to stalk prey, how to hit objects with a rifle at amazing distances. And all of those skills served him very, very well in World War One. And in fact, Barclay felt that his experiences growing up in the woods near Holden, Missouri, probably saved his life when he was on the battlefield. And he had this commitment to the outdoors his entire life. It came out in his childhood. It was evident in terms of what he did as a soldier in World War One. And then, of course, he was a well-known person in the Kansas City area right up until the time of his death, because he was so closely identified with the Shawnee Mission Park system and was so instrumental in making sure that public land was set aside for people to enjoy in that part of the Kansas City area.
So for a guy who grew up fishing and hunting and wandering the woods in Johnson County, Missouri, and becoming something of a killing machine in the First World War, the arc of his life ended with him devising parks and picnic tables and hiking paths and land in Johnson County, Kansas.
Indeed it did, yes.
Now, he claimed some kind of descent, maybe, to Daniel Boone?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I'm not real clear on the details there. I think he, needless to say, is not alone in that respect. Yes, he does mention that in his memoir. And, his daughter, Joan Barclay Wells, could probably tell you more about that. But I'm not certain whether that was the case or not, but I think that's what he believed.
Certainly Daniel Boone is the kind of pathfinder and woodsman that Barclay mm-hmm. would admire.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Now, this is a guy who, by his own testimony, it comes up often in his memoir, which was published in 1930 originally, mm-hmm. who believed that there were a lot of rules in the military and in life, and a lot of those rules simply didn't apply to him.
I think that's accurate. Yeah, I think that's accurate. Barclay was a very independent person, something of a hellraiser, really. I think things turned out well for him in World War One because he was able, really, based on his merits as a marksman, and again as a person who was so comfortable in the outdoors. He was selected for a very special training, and so his experiences were unlike those of most American soldiers in World War One, and certainly his preparation for battle was very, very different. Barclay was selected to be what he refers to as an intelligence man. And we today would probably use the term reconnaissance instead of intelligence. Intelligence sounds like covert espionage or spying or something like that. Barclay was a reconnaissance soldier. Really, that's what he was. And this meant that he spent a lot of time in harm's way, out in the middle of no man's land or being sent behind enemy lines. And so I think that that independence and that self-reliance, qualities that certainly got him into trouble from time to time, served him very, very well in the particular branch of the U.S. Army that he found himself in.
He appears to be a kind of guy who was wiry and strong, and he says he's a fast runner. In fact, he was playing football at Warrensburg State Teachers College when he entered the Army. But he had a tough time getting into the Army at first because of a speech impediment.
He did. He did. Barclay was a stutterer. And he opens his book, you know, talking about his efforts to enlist in the U.S. Army, and he had been thwarted several times by people who felt that the speech impediment was such that it would prevent him from performing his duties. And then he finally managed to get in when, according to his memoir, one of the doctors who examined him said, we need fighting men, not orators. And so he was able to join the military. And then he tells a story in the book of the day when he stopped stuttering. And it's a wonderful moment in the narrative, and it occurs near Chateau Thierry during the Second Battle of the Marne, and he is under enemy fire. Massive artillery projectiles are exploding all around him, and trees are being felled and all sorts of things. And there's a field telephone in a position that's buried in debris. And this field telephone is just ringing off the hook. There's some urgent message apparently that's being communicated from headquarters. And so an officer says somebody needs to go answer that phone, and nobody steps up to do it. And so Barclay says, "Well, I'll go take care of it." So he manages to narrowly avoid being blown to pieces by these shells, and finally gets to this phone. And answers it, and of course it's anyone who's been in the military will relate to this. Of course it's a totally trivial message that could have been relayed at any other possible moment, but of course someone was insistent that this message had to get through in the midst of this barrage. And so Barclay gets this message, and then when he's putting the receiver back down on the field telephone, a German shell bursts just a few feet away from him, and in fact, it blows the telephone up, and it slices the receiver in half that Barclay has in his hand, and it knocks him on his back, and he sees spots, and his ears are ringing, and he's not entirely certain whether he's alive or dead. But once he recovers from this, he returns to his unit, and people start looking at him strangely when he speaks to them. Because everyone has been used to his stutter, and now he is speaking without even a trace of one. And so Barclay tells us in his book that's the day when his stutter went away, and it never came back.
Oh my gosh. You're listening to Central Standard Friday on KCUR. I'm Monroe Dodd. Today we're talking about one of our region's most amazing yet least known war heroes, John Lewis Barclay. More than 80 years after it appeared, Barclay's World War I memoir has been reprinted under the title Scarlet Fields. We're talking with Stephen Trout, who wrote the introduction to the latest edition. Now, just making his way, Stephen, to that field telephone, he, in addition, obviously, to his skill at combat and at shooting and things, he led a little bit of a charmed life there, too.
He did. Barclay served in the 3rd Division in World War I, and these divisions in the First World War were about double the size of what they would be in World War II. So these were gigantic organizations, and they would hold up to 28,000 men. In all, there were 16,000 casualties. There were 16,000 people killed or wounded in the 3rd Division in World War I. And those losses occurred basically in less than a 6-month period. So statistically, Barclay was very, very lucky to be alive at the end of the war. And then given the fact that he served, again, as an intelligence man, as a person in reconnaissance who tended to have the most hazardous duties, that really makes his survival, doubly miraculous, I think.
Indeed, his luck started even before he left the country. He, like a lot of young men from these parts, got his training at Camp Funston on the outskirts of Fort Riley, and the flu was already ravaging that place then, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, absolutely. In fact, this is one of the dubious claims to fame of which the state of Kansas may boast. The Spanish flu epidemic really began in Kansas. The earliest recorded outbreak of Spanish flu occurred at Camp Funston. And you know, so you're absolutely right. You know, there were tens of thousands of American soldiers infected with that, and many of them died. About half of the approximately 100,000 Americans who died in World War I in the military, you know, succumbed to the flu. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. Barclay's luck was with him even before he left the country.
The United States officially entered the war in April of 1917, but it took quite a while until the troops began being shipped across the Atlantic. When did Barclay leave?
Barclay left in the late spring of 1918. And, you know, it's interesting, sort of the path that he took to go to France really says a lot about the military at the time. When Barclay was training at Camp Funston, he was slated to serve in the 89th Division, which was known as the Middle West Division. And this was a division made up of mostly men who were drafted, who came out of Missouri, Kansas, the Dakotas, Colorado. And basically, his name was pulled out in part because of his intelligence training that he received at Fort Riley, but it was also pulled out because the 3rd Division, which was supposed to be a regular division, that is a division made up of professional soldiers, you know, people who had served in the military prior to that declaration of war in April 1917. The 3rd Division was so short of soldiers because the pre-war American military was so small that basically they had to fill the ranks of that division any way that they could. And so Camp Funston, like a lot of other places where, you know, former civilians were being trained, was one of the camps contacted by the Army to supply soldiers for that 3rd Division. The U.S. Army was completely unprepared for the First World War. You know, the country had been riding high economically on the war, you know, through munition sales and so forth. You know, the Army itself was I think it's fair to say, almost completely unprepared for this conflict. So it took a long time to actually get soldiers trained, and many of them were poorly trained, and actually to get them to France and get them into action.
Now, John Lewis Barclay, as you mentioned, grew up getting a lot of skills that would serve him well in soldiering, but when he grew up, he probably hadn't been much farther in his life than Warrensburg or maybe Kansas City. Is that right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. One of the many great moments in Scarlet Fields occurs when Barclay sees the ocean for the first time. This is when, you know, they're about to embark from New Jersey. And, you know, you can just tell this was a thrill for this Midwestern farm boy to actually see the Atlantic Ocean. And he makes much of this in his narrative. He tells us a great deal about his impressions during the train journey, you know, from Kansas to the East Coast. This was all unfamiliar country for him, as it was, I think, for many of the young men who served alongside him.
Well, the world was an awfully big place in those days before television and radio and the internet. And Barclay even had a bit of a strange idea of what Europe would look like when he got there. And he was kind of brought up short by what he saw. What did he think he was going to see?
Well, it's really funny. He tells us in the memoir that he has some vague sense of France looking something like Egypt. You know, he expects lots of you know, Egyptian style public monuments and you know, ruins and things of this sort. And so he's quite taken aback when, you know, they arrive at a French port city, and you know, he finds France initially to be very grungy. You know, he thinks that people they don't have the best personal hygiene. The women all look sort of frumpy, and they're, you know, they're wearing very unattractive clothes, and they're walking in wooden shoes. So yeah, he goes from having this just, you know, ridiculously idealized vision of France to condemning it fairly quickly. He ultimately comes around, though. You know, he received additional intelligence training in France, and he was sent to a town in a beautiful valley, not far from Paris. And he tells us in the memoir that this was when he really began to understand that France was a beautiful country with very warm and generous people and in a rich history. And so I think Barclay came to appreciate and enjoy many things about France.
Yeah, indeed. It started to remind him of his native countryside, the forests and the hills.
Yeah,
now,
absolutely.
On the way to the front, which would have been on a railroad train, Barclay and his comrades mm-hmm. keep meeting French troops headed the other way on the way to the mm-hmm. rear. And mm-hmm. they keep saying, Safigny, Safigny, the war is mm-hmm. over for them. They have lost hope. Mm-hmm. At that time, Barclay and his comrades are too fresh, I guess, to lose hope yet.
Well, they are, and they arrive, you know, at the Western Front during a critical moment. You know, I think historians still argue about this, but I think some would say that Germany came actually quite close to winning the war in the late spring, early summer of 1918. You know, after the Russian Revolution and the withdrawal of Russia from the war, Germany was able to shift these huge reserves of manpower that had been really focused on the Eastern Front, shift them over to the Western Front. And so the German army launches a series of what come to be known as the spring offensives, and they capture a lot of territory, and they break through the Allied lines, and they come dangerously close, in fact, to capturing Paris. And so by the time that Barclay reaches the front, the French army is clearly demoralized. Not entirely, but certainly many of those units that Barclay encounters think that the war is indeed lost.
Now, this was a world war, among other reasons, because many countries in the world were involved to some extent, and also mm-hmm. because there had been an Eastern Front and the Carpathian Mountains. There was fighting mm-hmm. in Italy and other places. Mm-hmm. But most official U.S. forces were concentrated in the effort in northeastern France. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. There also were American divisions assigned to the British Army that fought in Flanders, in Belgium. There was one American regiment that served in Italy, and then, of course, as many people have forgotten, there were actually American troops deployed in Russia.
Oh, I didn't.
Both in Siberia and in North Russia.
I didn't know that. Now, here's Floyd. Floyd. Here is John Lewis Barclay, deployed in France, and he's made quite a few friends along the way. Two of his closest are two Native Americans named William mm-hmm. Floyd and Jesse James. Tell us a little mm-hmm. about them.
Well, these guys were regular Army. They were professional soldiers, and they had both served in China. If I remember correctly, they may have even seen service in the Philippines. So these were some tough men. And they are presented in Barclay's book very affectionately, but also with a great deal of respect. They really treat Barclay as an initiate. He's someone who has to prove his own bravery and his own fighting skill before they'll have much to do with him. And I think that's probably pretty accurate. Jesse James was murdered after World War I. He went back to the reservation in Oklahoma and, made a good deal of money through the oil boom and then wound up getting shot. William Floyd went on to become the president of the Regular Veterans Association, an organization made up of men who had served in the professional army. And he met up with Barclay decades after the war. They lost touch with one another, and they ultimately became reacquainted and renewed their friendship. So I think Barclay thought very, very highly of these men.
Barclay's originally, his book came out in 1930, which was, of course, a different era from our own. And mm-hmm. In a sense, there are some stereotypes of Native Americans mentioned in there, but they seem to be mentioned with great respect. And mm-hmm. you even mentioned that William Floyd and Jesse James, no relation to the outlaw from Western Missouri, are in a sense even acting out and trying to live up to some of those reputations.
Well, I think so. I think so. And I think that they were not unique in that regard. There's been quite a bit of scholarship done on Native Americans in World War I. There was an expectation, I think, on the part of many people in the Army in the First World War that Native American soldiers would be, particularly talented, people on the battlefield, in that they were coming out of cultures that had rich, longstanding warrior traditions. And so I think this was an expectation. And so I think many Native American men in the U.S. military in World War One, I think they, you know, there's great variety in terms of how people responded to that expectation. But I think many of them sort of embraced that. And I think you see that in the two soldiers who were probably closest to Barkley in his unit.
And here's this Caucasian guy from Western Missouri who wins their respect. These two Native Americans who are pretty capable characters.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's quite a bit of time sometimes between battles, and John Lewis Barkley, along with Floyd and James and some other pals, take some of that time to get into a bit of trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a bit about that side of John Lewis Barkley's character.
Well, you know, these guys, they enjoyed cognac. They enjoyed a wide variety of alcoholic beverages, especially if they didn't have to pay for them. And, so they put a fair amount of energy into locating, reserves of liquor, often under the noses of officers. And one very, I think, richly comic section of the memoir occurs when Barkley and his comrades, they find an abandoned French chateau, and they raid the wine cellar repeatedly. And ultimately, perhaps inevitably, the U.S. Army puts the chateau off limits because they want to move some officers into it. And this still doesn't stop Barkley and James and Floyd from regularly going in and taking whatever they want, and they manage to remove alcohol from the premises right under the noses of the officers who are living there.
Now, we'll be back after the break. You're listening to Central Standard Friday on KCUR, and today we're talking about the life of John Lewis Barkley, local boy who made Medal of Honor winner. Our guest is Stephen Trout, who wrote the introduction to the reissue of Barkley's memoir, which is entitled Scarlet Fields. Welcome back to Central Standard Friday. I'm Monroe Dodd. We're talking about the exploits of one of America's greatest soldiers whose name has not remained a household word. He's John Lewis Barkley. Barkley's memoir, first published in 1930, has been reissued by the University Press of Kansas. With us by telephone from Mobile, Alabama, is Stephen Trout, a professor at the University of South Alabama and a World War I scholar who wrote the introduction to the reprinting of John Lewis Barkley's book. Stephen, before the break, we were talking about Barkley and his pals and some of their ne'er-do-well escapades. And it did seem, indeed, that John Lewis Barkley in his memoir relished doing this kind of stuff, but he also relished combat. You also mentioned that he was not such a killing machine that he was not affected by the carnage he saw around him. For instance, on some of the trains, he saw the wounded coming back from the front.
Yes, that's absolutely right. I think Barkley, people respond to combat in different ways. And if I've learned anything studying, personal writing about war, it is that it's very difficult to generalize about how people will respond to that situation. Barkley basically had a pretty straightforward personal philosophy, I think, when it came to his service in the military and when it came to situations when he had to kill other human beings. I think he saw himself as a soldier who had a skill set that was particularly valuable to the U.S. Army, and he felt he would do what he had to do. And I don't think he felt a great deal of remorse, when he took the lives of German soldiers. But I don't think he necessarily relished that at the same time. There are a couple of moments in the book that are very, very striking that deal with the subject, and one of them comes relatively early when Barkley is serving as a sniper, and he's actually on the bank of the Marne River near Chateau Thierry. And he's firing across the river at German positions. And usually this is a matter of simply, you know, quickly seeing some light reflected off a helmet and then firing, as you know, at that spot, or seeing some branches move, or just getting a fleeting glimpse of an enemy soldier. And then one day he actually, through his scope on his rifle, he actually sees a German soldier standing out in the open, who has absolutely no idea that he's within range of Barclay's rifle. And so Barclay, you know, tells us in the book that all of a sudden he realizes that this is a human being, and he actually can see the face of someone that he's about to kill. And so Barclay, you know, sort of wrestles with this, and then ultimately he decides, well, you know, this is my job. And this is what I'm supposed to do, and an enemy sniper who had me in his sights would do the same thing. And so Barclay pulls the trigger, and he has a sleepless night afterwards, and obviously this haunted him, but he, I think, ultimately made peace with it.
Now, you write that fewer than half of the U.S. soldiers who landed in France ever saw combat, and most
right.
And most of that was at the Meuse-Argonne, but John Lewis Barclay was involved all over the place.
Yeah, he was. He was involved in the Aisne-Marne battle in the summer of 1918. He went on to serve at the Saint-Mihiel offensive, and then he was in the Argonne. So just about every major battle in France during World War I that involved Americans, Barclay was there.
And now, on the way to his most distinguished escapade of the war—I hate to call it an escapade—his the most thrilling part of the book, for sure, and mm-hmm. probably the highlight of his early life. It's October of 1918, and U.S. troops mm-hmm. are near the town of Cunel. Is that how it's pronounced?
Cunel.
Cunel in northeastern mm-hmm. France. His commander orders him to an observation post that, for all intents and purposes, is behind the German lines. He says, "Tell us what evolves from that."
Well, he's in the shell hole, and he's given the job of keeping an eye on the Germans. And the Germans are in a wooded area, probably about a half mile or so, or three quarters of a mile, in front of Barclay. Some woods called the Bois de Cunel. And he's supposed to be keeping an eye on them and observing their movements and so forth. And he's in a shell hole, and they run a phone line out to him. He has a field telephone. And so he's observing the enemy and phoning in, you know, coordinates for artillery fire and so forth. And then the phone line gets cut, as seemed to invariably happen in these sorts of situations. And so at that moment, Barclay has a choice. And he can either, you know, he's done his duty. He's recorded on the enemy's movements as long as he possibly can. He's done what he was ordered to do, so he can return back to headquarters, or he can stay and improvise and see if there's some way that he can personally intervene if these Germans he has been observing decide to move toward the American forces. And he chooses the latter, and he realizes that several hundred German troops are beginning to come out of the woods, and they're going to cross this field, and they're going to be attacking soldiers in the 3rd Division. And Barclay, once he realizes that, he sees an abandoned French light tank about 75 yards in front of him on the slope of a hill at a perfect position. If someone were to climb inside that tank and fire at the Germans. And so he sees that, and then he sees an abandoned German machine gun position with boxes of machine gun ammunition and abandoned German machine guns and everything else thrown all over the place. And as he's processing all of this information, some artillery shells carrying smoke begin to land in this field that is separating his position from the Bois de Cunel, and he realizes that this will give him an opportunity to make his move. So he runs to this abandoned German machine gun position. He grabs as much ammunition as he possibly can. He grabs a German light machine gun, and then he hightails it to this tank, and he gets into the tank and realizes that the tank's gun has been removed by the crew members when they abandon this vehicle, which leaves a fairly large, probably 1 foot by 1 foot aperture in the turret. And he sticks this German light machine gun through that opening and is ready to fire at these German soldiers. One detail here I think is kind of interesting. Whenever German troops would abandon machine guns, they would always remove the firing mechanism, what's called the breech block, from a machine gun. And Barclay, in his intelligence training, was told that you always need to carry one of these German machine gun breech blocks in your pocket, okay? And because you never know. You know, you might come across an enemy position, and you can pick up one of these guns. Well, sure enough, Barclay has just exactly the part that he needs in his pocket. In fact, he says in his book that it was all shiny. It had been, you know, from wear against his uniform. So he puts that thing into the gun and finds out it's operable, and then he waits for the smoke to clear and for this German force to move within range, and then he opens fire on them. And you know, it's just an extraordinary moment. The Germans are taken completely by surprise. You know, he probably kills dozens of enemy soldiers, and then they begin firing back at him. And you know, you can just imagine you're inside this turret with a 1 foot by 1 foot opening in front of you, and you're firing this machine gun through it, and you know there are literally hundreds if not thousands of enemy rounds striking the metal all around you, and some of these rounds were actually passing inside the tank and ricocheting all over the place. And they're hurling stick grenades at him. These things are bouncing off the tank and exploding. So he keeps us up for, several minutes. And then a German artillery piece at the edge of the woods starts firing artillery rounds, okay, at this tank. And, a couple of them hit the tank, and Barclay's knocked unconscious, and you know, not for the first time, thinks this is probably the end of his life. And then he comes to and, gets the gun in operation again and goes right back at it. It's just extraordinary. Yeah.
It's amazing. How does he get out of this?
Well, he gets out of it. He very nearly doesn't. You know, it gets to the point that the Germans he's shooting at, they become resourceful, and so small parties of men start crawling up on this tank, and what they're hoping that they can get into a position that will be close enough to the tank that he can't lower the barrel of the gun enough to actually hit them. Okay. Mm-hmm. And they very nearly pull this off. And then he realizes that this one particular group is dragging a bag containing stick grenades, and so he points the machine gun at the bag of stick grenades, and that sets them off, and it creates this huge explosion, which rocks the tank and everything else. And he's running out of water inside the jacket of his machine gun. It's a water-cooled gun, and so the gun starts jamming and misfiring. And so he solves that problem by pouring engine oil into the jacket, which is supposed to contain water. So you can imagine what that was like. And this fills the inside of the tank with smoke. After all of these things, finally, he sees the Germans falling back, and then he sees some members of his own division start to appear at the edge of this field. And it was just a case in which I think the Germans had had enough. I mean, they had come up against this maniac in this tank, and he just wouldn't quit, and nobody could get past him.
If a scriptwriter gave that to Hollywood, they would say it was preposterous. It's amazing. But for this nearly superhuman effort, you'd have to call it that, John Lewis Barclay won the Congressional Medal of Honor. And in fact, it was a big ceremony. The whole divisions were massed there to watch him and receive this. Mm-hmm. And he apparently didn't even know he was going to, and up strides General John J. Pershing.
Yeah, that's right. It's really amusing the way that Barclay presents this in his book. You know, he says that there's a big you know, there's a big gathering. You know, the entire division is assembled, and he has no idea what's going on. And all of a sudden, he hears his name called, and he thinks, you know, well, they're on to me at last. You know, all of these, you know, hijinks that he's been involved in, you know, going AWOL and you know, ransacking people's, you know, wine cellars and everything else, that it's all going to come back and haunt him. So he figures, well, his name's been called. He's being summoned to come forward because, you know, he's going to be, you know, shot or immediately dishonorably discharged from the Army or something terrible is going to happen to him. And he doesn't realize until, you know, Pershing, you know, stabs him with the pin on the medal when he, you know, pins it to his tunic that he's been given the Congressional Medal of Honor.
The highest decoration an American soldier could receive.
Yeah.
And pinned on by one Missourian, General Pershing being from mm-hmm. McLead to another.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And then comes the armistice, so barely a month later. And mm-hmm. that does not end the notorious career of John Lewis Barclay. His unit enters Germany, and in Germany he falls in love mm-hmm. with a young lady at a castle or mm-hmm. where his unit is kept. And then he gets a pass and heads for Paris. And once again he falls in love, or nearly so. He funds a lot of these now are escapades. He funds mm-hmm. his trip to Paris by doing some powerfully good gambling.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, he was very, very good at that. You know, in between these romances that he describes, in the latter part of the book, he also manages to get into trouble with the British Army and to actually be arrested along with one of his comrades by British military policemen. And then he and his comrade manage to disarm these military policemen. They basically steal their handguns. It's just with Barclay, it's one thing after another.
It's a gutsy incident in which they just sort of blow past these guys to go in to sit down with a bunch of officers who are relaxing.
Yeah. And Barclay didn't care too much for the British. He liked the French well enough, and I think he liked the Germans. There were some things about Germany, that he really came to appreciate when he was with the Army of Occupation in the Rhineland. He had tremendous respect for German veterans. I think one of the really touching moments late in the book comes when there's a German veteran, who's come home after the armistice from the Western Front, and you know he has his Iron Cross medal in a frame in his home. And apparently some soldiers in the Army of Occupation, it's not certain whether they're American or another nationality, break in and steal this medal. And Barclay goes to great lengths to see that it's returned to him. And I think Barclay, he was determined to kill as many German soldiers as he could during the war. And again, I don't think he had too many second thoughts about that. But once the war was over, he had just tremendous respect for his former adversaries.
You're listening to Central Standard Friday on KCUR. I'm Monroe Dodd, here with Stephen Trout, and we're discussing the life of John Lewis Barclay, the nearly forgotten World War I hero who was from right around here. In fact, after the war, Stephen, John Lewis Barclay returns to right around here to Kansas City, where he goes to work for a detective agency, I understand.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he did that. He went down to John Tarleton College in Texas, and he taught marksmanship to the cadet corps down there. But he also continued to work on his farm, near Holden, Missouri. And I think that's an interesting duality in Barclay, and one that I was quite struck by when I was working on this project and going through his papers, which are held at the National World War I Museum at the Liberty Memorial. I think Barclay, in many respects, was a very retiring, very private person who was happiest when he was probably out hunting or fishing, and he was quite content in many respects to return to that life after the war. But at the same time, I think this experience he had of fighting on the Western Front and experiencing these other cultures and other countries, I think that made a real impression on him too. And I think he realized that the world was larger perhaps than he had you know, understood when he was growing up in Missouri. So I think he was sort of torn in some respects throughout his adult life, really between those two sides of his personality.
The 1920s were not a good time for agriculture in this part of the country. It had been a great time before the war, and then people bought farms and found themselves caught in mortgages they couldn't handle. And John Lewis Barclay sees his own farm perhaps getting into financial trouble and thinks he can hit upon a scheme that will bail it out. And that's a book that he he meets a man who says you really ought to do a book about your exploits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. You know, I mean the Great Depression for the American farm economy begins in the 20s. And so Barclay, you know, he was taking care of his mother, who was widowed, and trying to keep the family farm in operation. And you know, so he was hoping that this book, you know, would become a great success and a bestseller. He was hoping that Hollywood would take an interest in it, and it would be, you know, translated onto the big screen. He really had great ambitions for this work.
Now, he wasn't a writer. He was a pretty good raconteur, but not a writer. But he had help writing and preparing this book.
He did. When he was down teaching marksmanship at John Tarleton College, he met a guy named Mike Mulcahy, who was, in fact, head of the cadet corps down there, who was the drill instructor. And, you know, Mulcahy really encouraged him to produce this book. And Mulcahy basically said, look, I'll ghostwrite it for you. If you'll provide me with, you know, the outline of the narrative, and if you'll give me detailed notes about what you experienced, I'll translate this into a, you know, into a grammatical account. And that's what he did. And then when Mulcahy managed to interest King Features, this publishing syndicate in New York City, in the book, Mulcahy drew up a contract with them. And then King Features decided that Mulcahy's version of the book wasn't quite what they wanted, so they brought in a team of editors, all of them women, who went over the manuscript, and they invited Barclay to come out in 1930 to spend 2 weeks with them so that they could ask him questions and have him look over, you know, this revised version of his account. Barclay was absolutely adamant in all of his correspondence that even though, you know, the narrative was massaged in a sense by this team of editors, that no falsehoods were added to it, that it reflected accurately and honestly his experience. And from what I can tell, comparing, you know, the book with Barclay's descriptions of things in his wartime letters and what I've been able to find in other accounts by other soldiers, I think the book is pretty faithful to that experience.
You've restored the title Scarlet Fields, but in its original release by the publisher, it was titled No Hard Feelings, sort of a bouncy title for a serious book.
It is. I think it's not a very good title, and Barclay didn't like it either. The original title that Barclay wanted was the title that the book has appeared under now, and that title is Scarlet Fields. And, you know, all of the early type scripts, which are in the John Lewis Barclay papers at the Liberty Memorial, all of those type scripts, you know, that come from the stage of production when he was working closely with Mike Mulcahy, they all bear the title Scarlet Fields. So the King Features made the decision, or the Cosmopolitan Book Company, which was its subsidiary that published this book, made the decision to call it No Hard Feelings. I have absolutely no idea why. Now, the phrase No Hard Feelings does appear in the book, and it appears at a relatively suspenseful moment. When Barclay is given orders to go out to that position from which he will observe the Bois de Canal and ultimately be involved in that action that will win him the Congressional Medal of Honor, the sergeant who sends him out there, you know, sort of understands that this may be a suicide mission, and Barclay understands that as well, and so they shake hands, and Barclay says to the sergeant, you know, no hard feelings if I don't come back, basically. So I think probably the editors in 1930, you know, sort of zeroed in on that moment in the text and said, oh, this would make a great title.
Despite John Lewis Barclay's highest hopes, the book did not do much to sell or bail out his farm. Isn't that right?
No, that's absolutely right. And I think there are a number of reasons for that. You know, the publisher became interested in this book in January 1930. It didn't actually appear until September. you know, by then, you know, the depression is worsening. The publishing industry is in free fall, basically. And, you know, this wave of interest that you have in the late 1920s and even into the early months of 1930 in the First World War, you know, when you have books like A Farewell to Arms by Ernest Hemingway, or All Quiet on the Western Front by Eric Maria Remarque, or Goodbye to All That by Robert Graves, you know, that wave of interest in the war when those great books are coming out, that really begins to wane as you get into the second half of 1930. I think publishers felt that, you know, the public has had enough of this topic, you know, things are not selling as well, and I think just the timing of Barclay's book, you know, I think it hurt it. I also think that the book received some negative reviews because people didn't understand, you know, what they took to be this enthusiasm on Barclay's part for the war. That didn't mesh well with sort of the reigning view of the war as, you know, something that was very mechanized and impersonal and universally horrible. You know, Barclay's account is all about individual initiative. It's all about, you know, the skills that he had as a soldier at this critical moment that enabled him to achieve a feat of arms that you know is just beyond imagination, and it's an absolutely compelling book, but I think it did not fit well with reigning views of the war.
His exploit certainly rivals those of Sergeant Alvin York, about whom mm-hmm. a movie was made, or the mm-hmm. flying ace Eddie Rickenbacker.
Mm-hmm.
But despite John Lewis Barclay's best efforts, the thing just didn't go. And so I guess he must have returned to the farm in Johnson County, Missouri, and then finally in the mid-1930s meets a woman from Johnson County, Kansas, marries her, and moves there.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's right. He marries Margaret Mullen and helps her manage her dairy farm. And, you know, over time becomes, you know, a well-known figure in the Kansas City area.
This farm was where today's Johnson Drive and Broadmoor intersect. Mm-hmm. He stayed involved with the World War, though. Apparently he was on the Liberty Memorial Board.
Yes, he was. He was on the Board of Trustees for the Liberty Memorial and was a great supporter of that memorial. He was active in the American Legion, in the VFW. You know, he was active in all of the different veterans organizations that helped to perpetuate, you know, memory of people's service in the war. And he took all of that very, very seriously.
But his early life spent in those woods sort of returns in a way toward the end of his life when he becomes the first park superintendent for Johnson County, of all things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's right. That's right. I think there is a sort of poetic way in which Barclay's life kind of comes full circle. And I think that you know, he felt that he had been shaped by those early experiences of the outdoors. And, you know, he could see, you know, with the explosion of urban sprawl in the Kansas City area, you know, in the 50s and 60s,
mm-hmm.
You know, that access to public land was going to become a real issue for people. So I think he was very passionate in his, you know, determination to make sure that the parkland was set aside and that families would have opportunities, you know, in spaces, you know, larger than their suburban backyards. To actually go out and experience nature. I think that was something he took very seriously.
And Antioch Park and the massive Shawnee Mission Park are the products of his efforts.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, that's right.
Now, his book was written in 1930. Only about 3,000 copies were published. Fewer than that were sold. And I believe it's safe to say for decades it was forgotten.
Yes.
It's been recently reissued with your introduction. How did that come to pass? What revived it?
Well, It's interesting. Probably about 3 years ago, I was having a conversation with a gentleman named Eli Paul, who was working at the Liberty Memorial at that time. He's with the Kansas City Public Library now,
mm-hmm.
and he knew of my interest in First World War literature, and he said, you know, you've been to the memorial, you've seen the display that has the Howard Chandler Christie portrait of John Lewis Barclay and the medals and so forth. Did you know about his book? And I honestly had never heard of it. And he said, you need to give this thing a read and see if you can find a publisher who would be interested in reviving it. And he told me that Barclay's daughter, Joan Barclay Wells, was serving on the Board of Trustees for the Liberty Memorial, and that she might have an interest in seeing her father's account brought back into print. And so that's really what started my interest in the book. And, you know, I located a copy and I read it, and immediately, I just thought, this is one of the most compelling accounts I've read by anyone in the First World War. The book was impossible to put down.
And you restored its original tentative title.
Yes, which I think Barclay would be happy with.
And it was issued this year by the University Press of Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's all the time we have for today's show. Our subject has been the amazing life of John Lewis Barclay, Medal of Honor winner in World War I, and author of a memoir that was first published in 1930 and then reprinted this year as Scarlet Fields, the Combat Memoir of a World War I Medal of Honor Hero. With us today has been Stephen Trout of the University of South Alabama, a former Kansas City resident, a World War I scholar, and the man who wrote the introduction to this new edition of Scarlet Fields. Thanks so much, Stephen.
My pleasure.
For more information on our guests and upcoming shows, visit our website, kcur.org. Central Standard Friday was produced by Andrea Salenzi. We had studio help from Kim Noble. I'm Monroe Dodd. Thanks for joining us, and enjoy your weekend.